Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. José Luis Rossi has been the Managing Director of Experian in the UK and Ireland for almost 4 years. But for the last four decades, he has enjoyed a successful leadership career that has taken him halfway around the world. He has held senior leadership positions at Experian, PwC and IBM, managing thousands of staff in 20 different countries. Born and raised in Brazil, José Luis originally trained as a mechanical engineer. But since then, he has established an international reputation as a highly respected business executive and change manager who thinks deeply about his leadership. So, José Luis Rossi, welcome to this episode of the NBS Business Leaders Podcast.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
Thank you. So, you're MD of Experian in the UK and Ireland. What does that entail?
Well, if I look at my job, I basically do four things, right? I work strategy with my team, define a strategy for the company. I look after the results of the business. I manage people, so hiring the right team, you know, motivating them. And the fourth thing that I think is one of the most critical ones is managing stakeholders. If you look at me in my position, I have to talk with regulators, clients, you know, my own team, direct reports, bosses, you know, consumers. So there's a lot of stakeholders to manage. And that is one, I think, the most difficult things that, you know, a CEO has to do.
So you spend a lot of time juggling?
Yeah, a little bit.
So which is the bit that you enjoy most?
Well, you know, my job, I'm always learning, right? Something new. And I also like to win in the marketplace. So, you know,
you
the
like
adrenaline of being, you know, running a successful company, it's also something very nice.
It's a great thrill being in charge.
Absolutely.
And is leadership always defined by your ability to win?
No, it's actually, you know, I'm a competitive person. And I think winning by doing the right thing, you know, is something that motivates me. But, you know, it's nice to have a competitive environment and that you can actually see that happening.
Okay, that actually feeds into, I think, what you're doing this evening. You're in Nottingham here at the Business School to give a lecture about, I think, the importance for business people and for all leaders of staying relevant in a changing world. So, you've been a senior leader, business leader for, as I've already said, more than four decades. So how have you stayed relevant? Has winning been part of that?
Well, staying relevant for more than 40 years is not that simple or easy, right? So it's a long career. And I'm going to debate a lot this evening with the business school about that. But there are three things that I think you could pay attention, right? First is technology. It's changed a lot, right? When I started my career, you know, the mainframes were the type of computer that a business would or government or whatever would use. And then you have the PC, you have the distributed computing, you had the internet, you had, you know, mobile, social network.
It's just come on a bit, doesn't it?
You know, it's if somebody sleeps and wakes 2 years later, it's already totally different. So you need to keep up to date with technology in any field of work, right? So that's one thing. But people think that being surviving is just, you know, understanding technology or products or things like that. I think what has really been difficult for people, and I see a lot of people being obsolete over the years, is because management has changed, right?
Over, you mean the practice of management?
Exactly. So when I started, you know, it was all about hierarchy, command and control, That was how biz were, you know, there was no appreciation for softer skills, right? Today, it's quite different, right? So today, you need to think about being inclusive. You need to think about horizontal organizations. You need to think about giving autonomy to people. And a lot of, you know, I see a lot of my colleagues actually going out of the market because they couldn't adapt. So I see more obsolescence coming from not understanding how management has changed than actually from technology change.
That's an interesting point. So it isn't so much the technology which has made many individuals obsolete, it is their inability to softer skills, social skills, the management skills that are now required in this century.
Yeah, and I would say that people that think they are up to date today, in 20 years, if they, it's going to be different, right? So the world is always changing and, you know, adapting. I like to say, you know, the, if there is a fight between the crocodile and the lion, who wins? Depends. In the swamp, the crocodile, right? In the savannah, the lion. So actually, it's adaptation that matters, right?
Right.
And the third dimension that I think is important to think is that the world is unstable and complex forever. So the time of cheap money, cheap energy, cheap logistics, no inflation, gone. And you need to understand or think that this continuous change is the norm now. And expecting, you know, an environment that will be stable, it's not, you know, what is going to happen. So being able, again, to adapt to those changing economic conditions that you cannot predict is another important way of, you know, staying relevant.
Okay. So you were appointed to be MD of Experian in the UK, here in, based here in Nottingham, after 6 years in which you are credited with transforming the fortunes of Experian in South America. What did you do there?
So Serasa, as we know in Brazil, Experian, it's the brand that Experian has there, was not consumer friendly, right? We were actually the company that were not that were giving the information to the market about people that were not paying their bills. So we decided to focus on our relationship with the consumer, right? And we built a business that had, you know, a couple of million consumers connected to us, to more than 70 million today. And we actually did that because we see ourselves as a B2B2C company, a company that actually has a direct connection to consumers and direct connection to the business. And because we have those two connections, we can actually help business understand better the consumers.
So it's B2B and B2C.
Yes. Okay. And what we did was actually giving consumers the opportunity to understand more about their financial lives. One thing that happens in Brazil a lot is people want to negotiate their debt so that they can get credit again. So we create a platform for negotiating debt in very interesting terms for the consumer. And they stop realizing that we are on their side, not against them. And that was a fundamental transformation of the business. And because we understand better consumers, our B2B clients start also coming back to us because they say, oh, Experian, Serasa in Brazil, is the platform that knows the consumer much better than anybody else.
Okay. So you were born and brought up and spent much of your working life in Brazil, although I think that you were a sixth former here in England. So you're a sixth former here in England, going back a number of years. What do you know now that you wish you'd known then?
Well, I was a teenager at that point in time, and it was fantastic time for me because there was no internet, no connection. So moving to a different country was actually almost the same as moving to a different planet, right? Those were a different Britain. It was pre-Margaret Thatcher, so very different. But, you know, all that culture was there, you know, the museum. So I really enjoy my time here. But, you know, if I look at my career, you know, at that point in time, there are two things that I didn't know it was very important. It took me years to realize. And one is the importance of networking, keeping your connections, you know, And I lost a lot, some of the connections that I had when I was here.
Even as a teenager, you were onto that already.
I was not.
Oh, and you weren't onto that, right?
That's why I think if I kept those connections, could help me later in life. Okay. And also personal branding, right? I didn't have any. It took me years to realize the importance of actually you build, you know, what you want to people to see you.
And you wish you'd started all that a bit earlier.
I think I would have benefit if I understand. Because today, with all the exposure that people have on social media, on LinkedIn and other, this is natural. Mm. It was not natural at that time. And if I knew that, I would be differentiated.
So I occasionally hear about people talk about born leaders. Did you always know that you were going to be in charge, even though you weren't building your brand sufficiently, as you put it? But did you know you'd be in charge? Do you think you were a born leader?
Not at all. I was not a leader in school. I was not a leader in university.
So when did all this start?
You know, I actually start liking to manage teams instead of actually executing.
All right.
So I felt that I could achieve results through people that I was coordinating, supporting and helping. And then I felt that I felt better doing that than actually, you know, create myself the solutions. And then I started understanding that that was management, right? And then I start studying about that, learning how to do it, what were the best ways of leading a team and so on. But most important, I think I learned most from examples. And I used to tell that I learn more from bad examples than good examples.
So give me an example of that.
So early in my career, I had a boss that he was my kind of mentor. So one day I go to his office. He gets me there and say, please have a seat. He didn't say anything. And he keeps on working. And then after 10 minutes, I look at him and he doesn't look at me. After 45 minutes, he said, our session is finished, right? And as your mentor, you need to remember that I'm a virtual mentor. I'm not really, you know, I don't really want you to do this job. He was giving that, you know, Well, you need to remember that that was in the days of command and control.
Yes.
It was accepted. It would never be accepted today.
He was just making a point.
Exactly. But my point is, that example, that lack of respect, that lack of empathy, and that, you know, totally not understanding why he as a manager could help me, right, gave me a great lesson. Said, you know, I need to, if I want to be, I felt so bad that I said I would never want somebody in front of me to feel the same thing.
Okay, so that feeds nicely into one of the first things you did when you became in charge of Experian in the UK and Ireland. You took 100 of your staff and did a 1 hour one-to-one with each of them. I've been told this by a couple of people who work for you, and it was a genuine two-way conversation. It wasn't just, this is how life is. And I did think, 100 hours. That's a big wedge of your time.
That was an idea that I had some years ago when I went to work in Europe, right? Ever since I, you know, had my career, I moved from job to jobs. I knew my team. Then I was invited to lead the IBM business in the south of Europe, 10 countries, 12,000 people. I didn't know anybody. I need to know my team. And by the way, my team was spread all over. So I said, I'm going to interview all my direct reports and the direct reports of my direct reports. But how can they open to me, right? So I said, I'm going to ask them, well, how long have you been in the company? Then where did you study? What are your hobbies? And all of a sudden, people would open, and I would learn much more about the business than all the reviews, business reviews, and other kinds of reviews that I did. So it worked there. So then I moved to Capgemini, I did the same thing. I moved to Experian, did the same thing. And it was very helpful for me because I joined the business in the UK during COVID.
And of course, you were managing UK and Ireland from Brazil.
I couldn't travel here, right? Yes. So I had to manage from there. So that was one of the tools that I used, interviewing, right. You know, the direct reports of my direct reports was a tool that I used to learn about the business, right? The things that people don't write, the people that don't talk in reviews, but they talk to you, right? When you are more in an intimate and genuine, you know, conversation. But, you know, the easiest part on that period was the remote working, right? The difficult part was first when, although they are similar, no, it's a credit rating agency in the UK and in Brazil, but they are different. Here's regulated, there's not regulated. Here is positive data, there's negative data. So I had to, change the engine of the plane without landing the plane, right? So I had to actually manage the whole situation in a way that I could be effective.
But would you have chosen to do the same thing? Or if you had chosen to do the same thing, would it have been more successful if you were here? If you hadn't had to do it remotely, if you'd been in Nottingham rather than Brazil, would you've done the same thing? And do you think it would have been even more effective face-to-face?
You know, it's interesting. Yes and no. Yes, because a face-to-face meeting is always better, right? No, because when I was interviewing people and everybody was at home, I was actually visiting their homes. And sometimes people were talking to me and their children would come, or their dog, or they had to stop to do something. So it became more intimate. If it was in our office, it was face-to-face, but not as intimate. So at the end of the day, if you ask me, hindsight, if I prefer to do that way, I think I would prefer to do it in a remote way than actually, because I could visit their homes, than actually, at that point in time, remember, there was no fake background. So I was, you know, it was...
You were seeing it all.
It was early days of, you know, those kind of video conference. So we were really visiting each other's homes.
So this remote working, if I can spread it a little bit wider, what difference has that made for leadership?
I think it's a new way of managing, right? So at Experian, we have a policy that we don't mandate going back to work.
Right? You don't mandate going back to work?
No. So go back to work, I mean going back to office.
No. Yes, I understand that. Yeah. But you're happy for your staff to work from home on a permanent basis?
What we do is we have hybrid working. Okay. But we think it's good to go to the office, meet people face-to-face, have some meetings face-to-face. But we let the teams decide.
Okay.
What we did is during COVID, we renovate our offices. So instead of mandating people go back to the office, we renovate the office, made them very attractive, very nice. You know, a place that where people want to go, right, instead of pushing them to go back to work in our office. And to be honest, I think we have good attendance in the office, especially Tuesday to Thursday. Monday and Fridays are more empty, but people go. And sometimes our, you know, parking at the Experian here in Nottingham is full. And I think it's better, you know, the way we propose. We treat adults as adults. Mature people as mature people, and I think they are enjoying that.
How has this affected productivity?
It's difficult to measure, but sometimes it's more productive, right? I can give an example. I'm a salesperson, right? Before COVID, I'm late. I need to cross London to visit a client. I'm late and so on. And, you know, I call him and I say, I need to change the meeting, right? And it's a problem that I change the meeting. Today, you would call, say, look, traffic is bad. Would you mind doing the meeting?
Sure.
You would do the meeting. I had a personal experience that I had to talk to a CEO in Scotland for something important. And we managed to schedule a meeting in 3 days. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the meeting, I asked him, if it were pre-COVID, how long would we take to schedule this meeting? And both of us said 2 to 3 weeks to discuss something very important, because we would need to do it face-to-face before COVID. I had to travel to Scotland, or he had to travel, you know, to London, and it would be a problem, right? In today, what we did is we just schedule a video conference 3 days later, and we solved the problem.
And much of that is psychology, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because you could have done it before, you just wouldn't have.
Not really. Before, I remember very well, in meetings where we had the option to do video and voice, only 50% of the people were on video. Most people were still on voice.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right?
Yes,
so
yes.
Actually, the COVID crisis have pushed everybody to be comfortable with video.
Okay.
So it's the dynamics were different. I think it would come, right, at some point in time, but, you know, it was not there.
It brought it forward. Beginning.
Exactly.
Okay. So back at your leadership career, it's been quite a process. You technology consultancy in Brazil, business management in Madrid, I think financial analysis. Now you're in Nottingham, now you're in Britain. In terms of your career, how did you decide when and where was the right time for a change?
It's all about cycles, right? At some point in time, you feel that your cycle has ended. There was one occasion where I didn't feel like that because when I moved to PwC, to IBM, it was not my initiative. You know, it was IBM buying the consulting business of PwC. So not my decision. But all the others were, you know, the feeling inside that, you know, I'm not learning anymore. You know, my cycle has ended and you need to do something about that. In two occasions, actually, I forced the situation. So I left IBM before I had a job in Brazil, and I left Capgemini before I had a job. You know, I moved to
Exeter. You took a chance.
If you have a good job, right, it's difficult to move. You need to have a compelling reason to find a job. I knew what I wanted. Right, I wanted, when I was in IBM Madrid, I wanted to go back to Brazil. And when I was at Capgemini, I want to change careers. So I had compelling reasons, but if you don't push yourself, right, you don't move. You have a good salary, you are in a comfortable position, you know, the company knows you, they know what they can expect from you, so you don't move. So, but once you find that, you know, feel that cycle has ended, is the and it's the moment of to move on. My suggestion is have a compelling reason for doing it.
Take a chance. Okay. Given all that you have just said, is there anything that you look back on and you think, oh, Lord, I wish I'd done that differently?
Well, I talk about networking and personal branding.
Need to pay the bills.
Yeah, but there's one thing that I would invest more in myself, which is public speaking. I was naturally a shy person, right? And I was never a great, you know, public speaker, speak to big audience. And I would have invested early in my career to master, you know, how to talk to big audiences and things like that.
Did you ever stand up and think, you know, I'm struggling here?
Well, I you know, when, I was once in a training with an actor, famous actor, and he told me that he was always 100% nervous when he went on stage. I said, but you've been doing this for more than 20 years. Yes, but every single day that I go into the stage, I'm very nervous. So I said, well, that's not bad. Now, if he is like that, I can feel not bad of not being comfortable. But I think I would have invested more in tools and skills to be more easy talking to large audiences.
Okay. So you've headed up businesses, I think, in 20 different countries, managing thousands of staff around the world. So what are there specific leadership challenges that are posed by this international career?
You need to be really aware of culture differences, right? And there's no right or wrong culture, right? There is your culture. But when you are working in a given country, right, you cannot think that is your way that is the right way, right? And I can give examples, lots of examples, right? So in Latin America, except for Brazil, they speak Portuguese. Everywhere else, we speak Spanish, right? And a Mexican and a Chilean is as similar as a French and a German.
Really?
Totally different, right? They speak the same language. And people will sometimes assume they are the same. Or, you know, the American culture and the European culture. I remember once that I was with my team in Spain, and everybody took the whole month of August for vacation. And the people in Armo, IBM, didn't understand. They went just 2 weeks. I said, but there is no clients there, right? Why they are going to be working if there is no clients? So one day, I couldn't convince them. But one day I'm walking into Madrid and I see the parking meter. And it says, Monday to Friday, 922-428. They don't charge during siesta. And then it says Saturday and August, 9-3. I said, oh, this is perfect. Saturday, actually, August is a big Saturday for them. So I took a picture and put in my presentation, say, that's what we need to do here. That's what we do. And they accepted.
It worked. Graphic representation.
Exactly. But, you know, but I see that all the time. And even, you know, between, I found it fascinating, between, you know, Americans and Brits, right? You know, you never say a zap here. It's always at your earliest convenience, right? And
that's just because we're very polite.
Yeah, exactly. No, or we do a presentation. You know, Americans always say, awesome, fantastic. And here, not too bad. You know? So it's
restrained.
And it's fascinating, but there's no right way. So the what you need to do is actually understand those differences and work around that.
Embrace them.
Absolutely. So I have a guide for that. There's a nice book called When Cultures Collide, from Richard B. Lewis. He has a chapter by country on etiquette for, you know, personal relationships, business relationships, what to do, what not to do for all the countries in the world. So when I travel to a country, even on vacation, I read that chapter because it gives me a lot of insights on what to do and what not to do.
So somebody told me that you were a big reader. What is that? Well, big reader and an avid photographer, the person who told me that. Is that a conscious thing, or is it just, look, you know, this is the way I'm built, I've always done it, or is it something that really does feed into your leadership?
No, you know, I read a lot about history, biography, personal experience, and those examples help me understand human nature, and I think helps in my leadership skills to understand people.
So is it important that leaders do have a hinterland, that they switch off, they do something themselves?
Absolutely. You know, and there is another thing, you know, it's much cheaper to, you know, learn from other people's mistakes than yours, right? So so it's very important. So I have, because I have the interest on those kind of, in that kind of literature, it has helped me in develop my leadership skills.
Okay. You're also the global lead for LGBTQ at Experian. So, you know, why is it important for senior business people like yourself to show leadership on that kind of big issue?
I think because it matters, because show that you care, show the right values for you and for the company. And I have a very specific point of view on this. So I think it's because it matters, because we care, and actually shows the values of that you have and the values of the company. A lot of times people say, oh, let's do that because that's good for business, right? Diversity is good for business, or this is good for business. I have a different point of view. I come from an environment where we do a lot of support for people with disabilities, right? Special needs. And I can guarantee you that it's more expensive, right? And if you try to make an inclusive environment for people with special needs, you need to have special equipment, you need to work around the issues, and it's more expensive. But we do it because it's right. So I don't like very much to say that, we are going to do this because it's the business is more creative, or it's going to be more profitable. And if it's not, would we stop doing it? So I think that, you know, diversity, inclusiveness is important because it's the right thing to do. And is the moral north that, for me, is important. Not if it's because it's good for business or not.
And is that something that, is that an idea in your own head in terms of your leadership and your business that has developed over a period of time? But were you always out there right at the start? And has, you know, and have you always had this, or have you recognized that this is an important part of leadership?
I think, you know, years ago, there was not much diversity in the work environment, right? Even today, when I go to some environment, it's a, you know, middle-aged, you know, white male environment, right? So it's important for us. Society is not like that, right? I come from a, you know, originally very, from a very humble background. My Italian great-grandparents were, you know, peasants, illiterate, you know, and they moved to Brazil, and they, you know, after 100 years, I could be where I am. So I know how important it is for people to have opportunities. And I think that being open, inclusive, right, is the right thing to do.
Good stuff. Final question. So as you know, this is a podcast for the Nottingham Business School. And I, as I understand it, you take a lot of inspiration from coaching. So if you were coaching students and academics today at the Nottingham Business School, what advice might you give them?
So I would start saying that jobs ends at 5 p.m., but careers don't. So
right,
you need to do more than the average, you know, person if you want to be differentiated. So a lot, you know, efforts pays. Second, obviously, I think we talk over here, never stop studying, right? You need to keep on studying all the time. I think it was Henry Ford that said that, you know, you should never stop studying, be it 20 or 80. You know, when you stop studying, you start dying, right? Because the important thing is to keep the mind young, right? So never stop studying. Other thing very important is be an actor of your life, right? Not a spectator. So act on it, right? It have your future in your hands. Don't let circumstances shape your future. And I, you know, I heard once from a guy, he was actually an education minister years ago in Brazil, a phrase that I like very much. He said, biographies comes before your career, and your career comes before your wealth. Never change that priority.
Right.
So at the end of the day, after 40 years, more important than my career is my biography, right? And that is what I have created, and which I'm very proud of. And it has nothing to do with my wealth. It has nothing to do with anything else but what I have built over the years in the relationships that I have with people.
That's fantastic. Jose Luis Rossi, thanks very, very much for joining us here on the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
If you enjoyed this episode, then why not check out some of the others that are also available, including those with the chair of the FA, Debbie Hewitt, England Women's Rugby World Cup winner, Maggie Alfonsi, MBE, and the Vice Chancellor of Nottingham Trent University, Professor Edward Peck, CBE. The Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast is produced for Nottingham Trent University by Celtic Tiger Productions. Your presenter was Mike Sassy, and your producer was John Collins.